Hello and welcome along to the Colchester Arts Centre Never Knowingly Understood podcast. And here in November, we've got some veritable treats coming up. So starting off, we've got an interview with Neil Birch from Zion Train, who will be performing at the Colchester Arts Centre on Friday the 17th of November. And it's definitely one not to be missed. So along with Cara Jane Murphy on vocals and a live band, they'll be creating some wonderful dub sounds for everyone to enjoy. But let's go over to Neil and find out all about Zion Train and what you don't want to miss.
You're going to be at Colchester Arts Centre on Friday the 17th of November.
Yeah.
Have you played there before?
We played a couple of times, but not for probably 18 years or so. We played a couple of times in the 90s. Had a couple of very nice nights up in the Arts Centre in the 90s.
And how's it kind of evolved? So what's the kind of lineup going to be for the 17th?
Well, what we have is our sort of standard full lineup, which is a lady singer called Cara.
Yeah.
A two-piece brass section.
Yeah.
Trumpet and tenor sax. And myself with electronics. That's been our full and standard lineup for all that time, sort of over 25 years. That's been our full and standard lineup for, although only myself and the trumpet player would have been at Colchester Arts in the 90s. So the sax player has played with us approximately a decade, and the singer's sung with us 5 to 6 years now.
And Cara, the singer, was that association, did that happen because she was in other bands when you were sort of kind of touring, or?
Yeah, she ran her own band called The Defectors. Yeah. Who supported Zion Train a good handful of times over the sort of previous 5 years. And also has a solo acoustic project that she still does, that she calls Cara Means Friend, which is also really nice. And yeah, that was how we associated. They'd supported us as The Defectors. Cara had guested with us on the occasional song while singing with The Defectors. And yeah, one thing led to another, really.
And how does the kind of sound evolve? Because if it's live mixing, presumably it's going to be quite different every time? Or is it?
Yeah, to be honest, Tim, that's part of the concept as well. We have all sort of slightly left field view, if you like, of performing live music. We've got a belief, really, that it's to keep the musicians engaged is of high importance, because without engaged musicians, you can't really expect an engaged audience. That seems a bit not feasible. And to keep us engaged, I mean, we've done over 3,000 shows. I've done over 3,000 shows as Zion Train. Of course, not always with the same material, but some of the tunes do last a couple of decades, you know, so some of the same material. And to keep us engaged, the only way to have it is for it to be variable or potentially variable every time. We often use guest musicians. We often are in a situation where we add a musician or add a singer or change a musician. And also on the technical side, because there's a live dub mix, there's a lot of the techniques we're using are very prevalent in the sound. Sometimes we change machinery, change technical setup, because that also imposes a musical change on what we're doing. And it keeps you engaged, keeps you interested, keeps you on your toes. And then I think people who have seen us numerous times, they engage with that. You know, if you've only seen us once or not seen us before, then you're not to know, you know. But I always thought it was slightly ludicrous and just a sort of function of the music business. The bands who play great music, write great music, perform great music, sound exactly the same on the CD, exactly the same in Colchester Arts Centre, exactly the same on the Pyramid Stage of Glastonbury. I mean, what's that? It's not real life, you know. So with the greatest respect to that sort of music and that sort of performance, we're into sort of being a little bit more improv,
Yeah.
going with the vibration on the spot on the night, you know,
And it
do our best.
is it kind of driven as well, very much not only by your kind of desire to want to not kind of play the same thing twice, but is it also how you kind of feed off the audience and how the audience react to the music?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. It's like the whole thing. The gig isn't just about a set of performers and giving something and people accepting like sponges, you know, an audience like sponges. It's much more like an energetic happening, you know. So there's exchange, ideally positive exchange, that where people feed off each other into it in a positive feedback cycle. So the audience like it. They show appreciation that inspires the band. In our world, we can reach out and try something different, because we're in that free framework of performing. And then if the public get onto that energy and realize sort of what's happening, then the thing can escalate quite nicely. And it's a very, you know, communal situation.
Yeah. And as well as the kind of music and the way it kind of engages with people, how important is the message as well? Because obviously you want people to go along and have a good time, but there's a lot of strong messages within the performance.
Yeah, I mean, again, we don't see any contradiction in a way. Yeah, of course, it's about entertainment, good time, dancing. But actually, in those sort of socially receptive states, that's when we best receive intelligent information. The reason, actually, that we're so brainwashed and controlled is that most of us are hurled, we get this incredible information hurled at us at exactly the wrong moment, in the wrong ways, through the wrong media, all day. And, you know, that's why people are sort of, I don't know, almost emotionally and socially living inside tortoise shells. A lot of people, they're not really living, because you know, the value systems of almost everything that happens in the Western world inside our experience are turned upside down. They're not as they should be. When you're in a moment, when you're relaxed, enjoying yourself, potentially with friends, with music or something like that that you enjoy, is the moment to receive good information. And we hope we can provide a little bit of that without you know, preaching to anybody, in a context where everyone understands what's going on. And everyone knows that amongst friends, which is another one of the problems, you know, the way media is and people respond to each other nowadays, it breeds paranoia. People, you know, look at the current global conflict. The facts seem clear, but actually, you're not allowed to say it in half of the world, which is, you know, that's totally so, it's like post Orwellian stuff, really. And you just accept it. I don't live in the UK. I live in Germany now for 20 years. And, you know, I think the UK is more out there than North Korea in so many ways. But again, you can't really say that in public. You can say it in select company, no? So it's all about trying to remind people that we're important, community is important, the fundamental things in our lives, like being grateful for life, being grateful for love and people around us, being grateful for time to think and consider consider what life is, to make positive choices. But those things are really, really valuable. And, you know, the way we control them on a day-to-day basis forces a lot of people into just making sort of buy and sell decisions. Politics is even functions in that way. It's black and white, buy and sell, and, you know, binary decisions. And you know, we're not like that, and life isn't like that. So the whole atmosphere we try and engender with the music, we like it to be suggestive of that. You know, we're multipolar beings, and you know, we should be able to deal with that.
What were your kind of musical influences? What was the sort of thing, kind of maybe the sort of early sort of formative ones that you get when you're kind of like a teenager? And then was there something that kind of struck a chord? You say it's kind of, there's a lot of social awareness, political awareness, world awareness. Were there particular artists that maybe kind of inspired that
Yeah,
direction?
absolutely. Between I could myself and speaking also for other members of the band, I could say in general, you've got sonically, you've got things like Jamaican dub, King Tubby, sort of more mainstream political things like Bob Marley, also, of course, fantastic Jamaican vibe in there as well. Sonically, again, Jimi Hendrix really is the way. There's a certain thing that the musicians at the level of Jimi Hendrix managed to do is manifest thought in the listeners' minds by the use of their instruments without necessarily using words. And that's like a that's you know shamanistic magic. And there's many musicians who work on that level, like Sun Ra, John Coltrane, those people. But then politically, Fela Kuti, John Coltrane doesn't sound like Fela Kuti, but the energy in his music as a third world political powerhouse, really. But then also two-tone, I could say that we were definitely influenced by the sort of socio-political and cross-cultural Britain representation that would be two-tone had coming out of the West Midlands. And punk rock, of course, lots of different stuff. It's a very sort of UK-based scene with a few world things thrown in there.
And with the, because you've also got the kind of the record label as well. I mean, how did that all kind of come? So with the, is it Universal Egg? I mean, how did that all come to start? Did that initially come out of kind of the dub kind of stuff that you were doing, and then kind of evolve from there, or change, or?
Over the years, we've run four labels, and Universal Egg has been the one that's had the longest life and is actually the only one still publishing new releases. And initially, the labels were on us all started to showcase music that Zymeworks or members of Zymeworks were doing as different side projects. And then, as things progressed through the 90s, and Zymeworks had a separate record deal with China Records, the Leathers, More Chiba label, then Universal Egg and her sister labels carried on releasing side projects and also other music that was brought to our attention. We had a sort of musical policy, given that we were traveling a huge amount and being exposed to a lot of new and eclectic music. We had a musical policy of using our labels to just sort of release and present music that we didn't think was getting enough exposure and was being exposed to us. Some things more commercially viable than others. I mean, Universal Egg did releases of music concrete that you'd struggle to sell 100 copies of because there's not that many crazy people around in the world, and to sell in reasonable tens of thousands of physical copies of CDs and vinyl when that was still a feasible and possible thing to do for an independent record label. Now, like I say, we'd rarely release other artist music other than Zymeworks like for the last 3, 4 years. And of course, we were a record label born on the crest of the internet when the internet was sort of just breaking through, and our bread and butter was really physical vinyl. For years and years and years, we still do physical vinyl, but to see change in numbers that's gone on in the past couple of decades with that sort of business. So we tend to do most of our music digitally at the moment.
And thank you there to Neil for a fascinating interview. And I apologise because the sound quality was a little bit hit and miss. But Neil was there, based over in Germany. So right now, coming up.
we've got mixed picks. So this is where resident art centre guru, an all-round, he's a hippie, will be telling you about some of his picks for the month of November. Mixed picks are like a celestial flying teapot ride around a patchouli-scented galaxy, guaranteed to bring wonder and open the doors of perception.
Well, mixed picks for December. It seems to have been a while. Couple quite close together. Thursday the 7th, that's DC. Tuesday the 12th, Spear of Destiny. That's your lot for mixed picks this week, or month even. Yeah, that's about it really.
And thank you very much there to Mick the Hippie for some stellar picks.
Coming up next is an interview with Jay Stapley and Robin A. Smith, who will be coming to the Colchester Arts Centre on Saturday the 25th of November and bringing, their seasoned professional session musicianshipness along with a little bit of improv. And if you don't know the names, then they have played with such people as Grover Washington, Burt Bacharach, Rod Stewart, Goldie, Roger Waters, the list goes on. And I believe you'll find out in a minute. They met whilst performing along with Mike Oldfield. So over to Jay and Robin.
You've played at the Colchester Arts Centre on your own.
I have.
Have you played with Robin before at the Colchester Arts Centre?
No. Robin and I have spent the last 3 years doing the Tubular Bells 50th anniversary shows. He did an arrangement of Tubular Bells that we performed at the Royal Festival Hall in 2021.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've been touring it. So no, but we've played a couple of art centres, a couple of other art centres doing what we do.
And how did your paths originally cross?
Robin was the arranger and conductor who did Tubular Bells 2 live when Mike decided he wanted to do it live. He hired Robin to do the arrangement and to conduct it. And we did the premiere at Edinburgh Castle. Where they do the tattoo on the parade ground at the front of the castle, they just left all the bleachers up and put up a stage. And we premiered Tubular Bells 2 there. And then we did the Albert Hall with it. And then we toured Europe with it. And we did a tour of Spain with it. I was one of the many guitarists who were hired to do it. I think the first show in Edinburgh, I think we had four guitarists, but they cut it down to two or three for the touring show. But that's how we met. And then he approached me to do the Festival Hall shows.
Mm-hmm.
And despite my best endeavours to annoy the hell out of him, I'm still there.
And how did you originally get started in a career within music? What was the inspiration?
I started playing the guitar. My father was a teacher who used to teach teachers to teach, if that's mm-hmm. not inelegant construction. And he was a great piano player, but he wanted to be able to help his students learn the guitar. So he bought a couple of guitars and bought one home. And I picked it up and opened a chord book and went, oh, yeah, I can do that. And when I was about 15, I'd had a band at school. And I thought, I actually really want to do this. And when my school wanted me to go to university, and I thought, if I don't have a go at this and I end up at the age of 30, you know, doing a proper job and knowing that I never even gave it a try,
mm-hmm.
I'll be probably quite angry and a little bit bitter. Whereas if I give it a try and I fail, I can go to university afterwards. So I gave it a try, and I've been giving it a try ever since. And it's now 50 years later. I've been doing this for half a century. And I'm very fortunate to still be working. I count myself lucky. Yeah, there's plenty of people of my age that aren't working. But, you know, the business has changed vastly, and you have to go with it. You have to roll with it. And you know, I actually officially retired in April, although I've never been busier. And it occurred to me, I was looking back and thinking, you know, I've spent my entire life constantly reinventing myself. You know, you've got to learn whatever the new thing is, and you've got to learn this, and now I've got to learn how to do that.
Mm.
And I don't have to anymore, but I still do. I'm still interested. And, you know, but I do most of my work from home. I do a lot of online sessions for people all over the world. And I write and record music, and I'm very happy and very lucky still to be working.
And so, I mean, and it's obviously changed now, as you say, you can record at home and then just transfer files, presumably, yeah, rather than have to go to a studio.
Exactly. Although I actually am going to a studio on Monday, which is why I had to reschedule this, because I've got a call from somebody I've known for years that was going to be just a morning session and has turned into an all-day session.
Mm.
I mean, the concomitant, the other side of the thing about, you know, just being able to, you know, send files around the world is that the amount of money there used to be in the sales of recorded music has plummeted.
Yeah.
So budgets for making records have plummeted, and people like me have had to accept that what I now get for a session is pretty much what I used to get in the early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Because artists just don't have the budget. Because in order to earn a grand, if you make a recording, in order to earn a grand, you have to have 1.25 million plays on Spotify, which most people will never achieve. So the budgets, you know, they don't have the money to spend that they used to.
I think the thing with Spotify is that, obviously, what's your perspective? Because I guess, the artists can get more exposure than maybe they might have been able to otherwise, but the actual remuneration is very insignificant.
As a user, as someone who likes to listen to music, I love it because the whole of recorded music history is at my fingertips. I actually pay a premium, you know, I have a premium account, so I pay for it. As an artist, I hate it. And you say you get exposure. How on earth, how do you cut through the mush? There are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people uploading tracks to Spotify every day. How do you get heard? I mean, it's Spotify is part owned by the major labels. So they, you know, they pump their artists because they control the platform. So you've got to cut through. It's very, very difficult. But one of my sort of things, when the industry started changing, I remember saying to myself, I'm not going to turn into a bitter old muso down the pub. I will go with whatever the changes are and do what I can. Talking of bitter old musos down the pub.
Good evening.
Which is where I should be. Evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
Told me they were going to do that. Bloody Nora.
Well, I'm sorry if we've traumatised you at this early point of the evening. So I'll make it all relatively quick and pain-free.
That's good. Lovely to meet you, Tim. All the best.
Lovely to meet you. I was just talking to Jay and sort of asking about how you got to kind of gather and everything. So I've kind of got the background on that. But if I can kind of ask you, Robin, how did you get interested? How did you become a musician and an arranger? What's the kind of background?
Oh, it's fantastic. I mean, so I started playing the piano when I was five.
Yeah.
And I just had this thing. It's blooming weird. I came back with this thing of just loving it, everything about it. But I had this ability, strange enough, to play, to actually be able to, I was learning classical music, learning to read, but I had the ability to actually sit at a piano and just play.
Mm-hmm.
So that led on to this fantastic fascination with, see, in those days, in the old days at school, we used, I mean, no, but it did, it's true to say, you know, English folk song, British folk song, sorry, was a, you know, was a big factor in our lives. You know, your school assembly, we'd be singing some, you know, whether it be Scarborough Fair, whether it be it was always there. So as a young kid, I just got fascinated in, for example, Benjamin Britten, mm-hmm. right? So one of the great composers who, along with Vaughan Williams and, you know, some of the others, had this same thing of taking English, British folk songs and rearranging them. So at the age of, and I heard Scarborough Fair, not Scarborough Fair, Down by the Sally Gardens, arranged by Benjamin Britten for Peter Pierce to sing. And I got the music from the library, and it completely blew my mind. The idea that you knew in school that it was going to be basic sort of triads and da-da-da. Suddenly I'm listening to a very simple melody, beautiful melody, that but suddenly you could change the nature and the emotion of those words through harmony. It was mm-hmm. extraordinary. So that was my beginnings to arranging. So I started arranging folk songs, and so and that went on all the way through my sort of career into Royal College of Music, into National Youth Jazz Orchestra, and out of that, and then working as a session musician, as a keyboard player, but always arranging. That's it. That's my life in a nutshell.
Okay. And so you're you're performing together on the 25th of November, yes. Saturday.
Fantastic. Yeah.
So what can we expect from the evening? Because I was looking at the little bit of blurb on there, and it says in the style of Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, JJ Cale. So what can we expect?
We kind of do, if you imagine, like improv comedians will say, say, okay, we are two elephants marooned on the International Space Station. Go. So we'll say, okay, here's a melody from, I mean, talking of your folk song things, I'm intrigued by the notion of you being in the National Youth Jazz Orchestra, trying to persuade him to play Scarborough Fair. That's an image that I will cherish. But well, we might say, yeah, you know, there's a, what's that song? Women of Ireland. There's a traditional song. We'll say, okay, that's the melody. We'll start with that. And then wherever it takes us is where it takes us. And it might go, you know, we might suddenly go from playing the melody of Women of Ireland in a traditional style, and it might suddenly turn into Bill Evans and Jeff Beck playing the melody and work, you know, moving, working around that melody. So we kind of, we have those starting points, but where it goes is where it goes.
But okay. It's always beautiful. That's the it's key part beautiful. About this. It's the thing that what's wonderful playing with Jay, it's always about that natural emotion of music. And it's not just music for its own sake. It's music for the music's sake and for the listener. And that's what we love.
And because my father was such an extraordinarily great piano player, I've always revered pianists. And despite my best endeavours not to revere Rob, he's one of the greatest pianists I know, and it's a great joy to
explore. It's a mutual appreciation society that we love to bestow on the listeners, and it's a great. It's we just love doing it.
Off stage, we're at each other's throats almost constantly.
But consummate professionals once you're on the stage, then.
Yeah. I'll just ignore him. I can't resist.
One likes to think so, yeah.
Okay.
And I also think, I mean, I've always found the electric guitar and the you know, the piano an intriguing combination, because I love the sophistication you can achieve with a piano in terms of having two different things going on at once, which you can't really do on a guitar. I kind of try sometimes, but I love to be able to play single note melodies across this rich tapestry that comes out of the one instrument.
Absolutely. And it's true to also say that with a piano, because you can't do anything with a singular note. You can't suddenly bend you can try bending it, but it ruins your fingers. or you can throw knives at it like Keith Emerson used to, but that doesn't it's a great combination. So we're really looking forward to it.
Yeah.
Excellent stuff. And as you say, a lot of it's going to be improvised, so it can just literally go wherever you feel it's going, or
That's the kind of I mean, it's not like we're walking on stage and we've got a clue what we're doing. We have a sketch pad.
Yeah.
But it's not a, oh, this is what we do exactly the same every time. It's that's the beauty. You never really know where it's going to go. And it's exciting for me playing with Jay as it is hopefully for the listener.
I think there's a certain element of it means you don't have to rehearse, although we do. We have a quick sort of, we run through the basic notes on the sketch pad and go, okay, we'll do that. And it takes on a life of its own.
Yeah. And I mean, we are very lucky.
My way of playing has always been, you know, I never learned to read. To read music, I play what I hear in my head.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm playing with another musician or a band or whatever, they'll play something that suggests something to me. And I'm lucky enough to have to be able to find the notes I can hear in my head on the guitar as they come to me.
Yeah, fantastic.
And that's for me a great joy.
And is it because you've both been heavily involved in playing with numerous artists and also doing lots of session work? Does that then make it easier to be able to kind of follow and adapt rather than playing in a certain style?
Yeah.
Because as a session musician, you have to, especially, probably not so much now, but certainly in the days when we were coming through the ranks, you needed to be a true musician. You needed to be turning up at 10 o'clock for a session with the ability, if somebody said, oh, today you're doing a polka or you're doing Black Sabbath, you had to, but you can just press a button these days, actually.
I learned my craft doing jingles, and I always used to be in awe of the singers who did jingles, because they would turn up, you know, on a cold, wet February morning and sing about cornflakes as though it were the most important thing in their lives. It was an extraordinary ability these people had. And we had to do the same. I mean, as a guitar player, you had to be able to really quickly create any sound. Quite often they'd have a reference track. They'd say, okay, we want it to sound like Bob Marley, Three Little Birds, or we want it to sound like Earth, Wind and Fire. And you'd have to go, okay, I can hear what the sound they're using. Okay, I can build that sound. And the style, you'd have to be able to go, right, okay, basically it's that kind of idea. Oh, yeah, I'll do that. And it was a fantastic learning experience. But then, you know, you'd get into more serious sessions with sensitive artists who would say, yeah, I need you to sound like a tree in winter. And you kind of go, okay. Because, you know, music can do certain things and it can't do certain others. Music can do emotion and attitude. It can do anger and love and tenderness and sadness. But it can't do the colour purple. Although I think Rob's going to disagree with me on that one.
Well, I'm just... Which session were you on where somebody asked you to be a tree in winter?
Some sensitive folky somewhere down the line.
I think I know what my answer would be. Yeah, certainly.
No, but you know what they're like. You know what?
No, absolutely.
You can't give them the answer that you would want to.
No, and mostly most people who would say anything like trees in winter, you know that they're on some sort of substance abuse.
Mind altering.
I would try and interpret what emotion or attitude they wanted. What they meant by that. You know, are we talking lonely? Are we talking isolated, cold, dying?
Has there in the kind of careers that you've had, I know this is probably quite a crass question to ask, but have you individually got a session or a working with a particular artist that you think that was the moment?
I've got a few.
Yeah.
I've definitely a few for me, yeah. There's definitely also a few where I would go, that was a nightmare.
Okay.
But yeah, I've had a few. I mean, with My main artist for many years was a German guy, a German artist who was massive in Germany. We used to play football stadiums. And he used to come over here to make his records. And I remember one record, there's a song that ended up being a massive hit for him that we played first take. And the producer on the session, who was a piano player called Pete Wingfield, said, "Oh, we got lucky there. An angel just walked through the studio." And he was right. It just went perfect. Mm-hmm. And when it happens like that, it's like it's as though you've not, you don't have to make any effort to do it. The music just flows through you. So yeah, there's a few moments like that.
Okay. And has that, you mentioned sort of nightmare scenarios of maybe not particularly going the way that you would want it to. Let's leave those to one side. Is there, from both of you, is there an artist that you haven't worked with that you would like to work with?
Bowie. David Bowie, my Desert Island artist.
Okay. And what?
Mine's James Taylor, so I just want to be in the same room with him. I don't.
I could see that. Yeah.
Well, I think you've possibly got more of a chance in fulfilling that particular.
Funnily enough, yes,
he's actually alive.
And thank you very much there to Jay and Robin. And I hope you get the opportunity to come along. And that is on Saturday, the 25th of November. And you're guaranteed a great evening. And, well, if you'd like to hear a little bit more, you can head over to Mixcloud, where you can hear a podcast containing some musical selections as well. Thank you very much for joining us. And we'll be back again next month with, well, more wonderfulness. And, well, don't forget to pop down to the Arts Centre and have a fabulous time. See you next month.